This is NPR Music. I'm Tom Heisinga. You know, if there's one thing you can count on in the classical music world, it's the constant gloom and doom forecasts, ranging from the death of classical music in America to drastic reductions in audiences, orchestras, and opera houses. Well, a few of those dire predictions, along with a healthy dose of good news, can be found in this month's Opera News magazine. Its cover story celebrates opera's quote-unquote next wave of pioneers and up-and-comers, from singers and directors to administrators. And here today to talk about the future of opera, especially in this country, is the co-author of that cover story, F. Paul Driscoll, editor-in-chief of Opera News. Welcome, Mr. Driscoll.
Thank you.
Also with us is one of those fresh faces of the future, a singer highlighted in the Opera News article, countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo, who made his Met debut last season. Many thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much.
And Anne Majette is here, the classical music critic of the Washington Post, an author who has spent much time thinking and writing about the health of opera and classical music. Anne, so nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So, F. Paul, let me start with you with the easy question. What inspired this cover story of opera's next wave, the voices and faces of the future?
Opera News very often does theme issues in July and August in the summer, and we thought it would be a good idea to take a look at where opera might be headed next and look at that through the prism, as it were, of some interesting performers and administrators and directors and conductors.
From reading, you might get the impression that opera is on a sure foot.
I think that what we looked at was people who had a chance to do good for the industry and do good for the art form within the next decade. I think what is interesting about the people that we chose is that they are all in a very good place in terms of what they've done with their talents and skills and what they've done with the particular job assignments that they've been given. Whether or not this is a golden age, I don't know. I mean, I like to think every age has the potential to be gold. We don't know if it's real gold until we rub it a little bit, do we?
You know, it's intriguing that just before the kind of the good vibes cover story, there's a very provocative article by Philip Kennicott, who doesn't exactly see opera's future as all that rosy, does he?
Well, Philip is looking at opera in that particular essay from the point of view of technology, and he takes in a lot. He talks about virtual opera performances, the influence of HD, what the impact of that would be. And I think Philip is also taking the tack that all media is facing challenges from the increased availability of technology and the speed with which technology is developing. I am not a technological person, which you can't tell to listen to me because I sound so expert, but I just got my first iPhone a couple of days ago. But who knows what shape the technology will be in 5 years from now.
Well, one of the points that Kennicott tries to make in the article is that, you know, the HD movie theater transmissions, the cameras, the microphones, the very fancy audio mixing, the kind of perfecting of opera is actually serving to kind of separate us more and more from real-life opera. What do you think of that?
Well, that's been true of every form of recording since the recording industry began, and you see a real bifurcation between the record-buying audience, for example, and the concert-going public. It's not the same people often. So, yes, you could argue that HD is creating its own kind of experience, which is unique and distinct from live opera experience. But you could also say that that kind of technology is why we're able to listen to Caruso today. I can be very critical of HD because I do think that the experience is a kind of slickness, like eating potato chips. It's a very easy access form of opera. On the other hand, I enjoy it, and there's a chance it can be reaching new audiences, and certainly it's bringing opera to a much wider audience than was previously possible, and those have got to be good things.
Some people are wondering whether it's actually luring people away from, you know, from their local and regional opera houses, that, you know, they can go to the theater and have a good time and eat popcorn and see a production at the Met or some of the other houses now that are doing HD broadcasts, but then not spending the money on their local opera house. F. Paul, what do you think of those kinds of worries?
I think it's depends on the particular opera company and what the population of opera goers are. I mean, certainly in New York, there are lots of people who want to consume classical music in one form or another and lots of opportunities to do so. I think in other communities, Portland, Maine, for example, which has one opera company that presents one opera in the summer, they have to be very careful about how they program their summer piece based on what the Met has presented in the local movie theater the previous spring. And I think that's a way of being nimble and looking at exactly what the competition is.
I used to blithely say that it was much the same as baseball. When baseball went on the radio and then went on TV, people said nobody will go to the ballpark anymore. And in fact, people went to the ballpark in greater numbers. We now have more baseball teams and more playoffs. That, unfortunately, I think has not happened in opera based on my conversations with opera administrators. People are not necessarily flocking to their local theaters in quite the same way. The HD has not provided that kind of funnel.
Anthony, we've heard a lot about the pros and cons of the Met and other houses that are doing live HD broadcasts, and I'm wondering what effect it has on you, the singer. Do you feel, when you're up there, do you sing, you act any differently when you know that that high-tech camera is like staring you right in the face?
Well, this was my first season doing an HD broadcast, and I have to say, going into it, I was very nervous, and I would watch the monitor backstage before I went on going, they don't look like they're swallowing or clearing their throat, and what if I have to do that? So there was a certain anxiety, but once you get out there into the auditorium, there are 4,000 people sitting there, and you know, I've been performing for 20 years now in musical theater, Broadway, film, and finally opera, and so my instincts told me just perform, and as a singing actor, I try never to be overly theatrical and or too naturalistic, so I think it meshes well with the HD format.
It's interesting that when you read the descriptions of some of the singers in the Opera News article, there are so many of them that actually mention HD broadcasts and worrying about how to act properly in front of that camera. What are you hearing from your fellow singers, Anthony, about the HD broadcasts?
I think people do get preoccupied with it, and I think it enters their sort of all singers, all of us, if I can say this, we have this neurotic side, which begets our quest for beauty and all sorts of things. But I think it does enter our psyche, and I think those who are most successful tend to sort of push it away and do what they do. I see opera singers up close, just like an HD broadcast, every day. You know, I'm working with them, and I see them act from that close. And really, no one is acting in a way which is why most people that are really good are not acting in a wildly overdramatic way. You know, opera is a pretty cathartic art form. I think it sort of takes on these moments which really only occur a few times in our life, these very dramatic moments. And that's what we're portraying. So I think that people who are really successful don't change the way they perform for the camera.
F. Paul, there are a lot of singers listed in your cover story, 14 out of the 26, actually. And one of them is tenor Michael Fabiano. Let's take a listen. A little bit of Lenski's aria from Eugene Onegin, sung by Michael Fabiano, who is one of the kind of opera's up-and-coming singers listed in the Opera News article called Opera's Next Wave. And we kind of stole that from the movie The Audition from a few years back, when Fabiano and a few others were competing for the Met National Council auditions. So, lots of singers listed in the magazine. Are we, F. Paul, are you implying that we're in some kind of golden age, flush with a lot of great talent right now?
I think there is a lot of great talent. I think there's always a lot of great talent, but talent is an accident, like having red hair or being left-handed. Just because someone is talented does not mean that he or she is going to be a success. I think the ingredients are there for all of these men and women, and I hope that they have success going forward. It is great for us to be able to cover an industry that has so much talent in training. I worry sometimes that, you know, there's going to be so many talented singers and not enough jobs for them going forward, because that is a narrowing field of employment.
I would point to something else in the Opera News issue that I think is a very heartening sign of the times. In 2005, I did an article about voice training and the difficulty of training large voices in an environment that encourages young singers to be put in small roles so they get practice on stage, which is not where you want a Wagner singer in some Compromario role. But I notice in the Opera News article there are several singers with big voices, and I know that people did begin to realize that this was a problem, and young artist programs began working to try to catch the big voices, which tend to mature later and not be as flexible and not be as easy to put in little bitty roles on stage. And it's nice to see that there are some big voices, the Amber Wagners, the Angela Meads, coming up, Latonia Moore. You know, may that continue.
Angela Mead is another one of those singers spotlighted in the magazine. Let's talk about her, but first let's hear her sing a little bit. That's Angela Mead with a snippet of Casta Diva from back in 2007 when she won the Met National Council auditions. Anne, what do you think about that voice?
It's an impressive voice. I happened to do an article about those 2007 auditions, which seems to have been one of those years. And I remember seeing on the program that one of the singers was going to do Casta Diva and thinking, oh, yeah, right.
and then?
Really being blown away. I haven't heard her. I've heard her on an HD broadcast of Ernani since then. Which is, you know, there's a lot of issues with trying to sing Verdi in this day and age. She's got a lot of talent and a lot of ability, and, you know, may she keep developing. F. Paul said talent is an accident, and that's true, but there's so much hard work, mm-hmm. even necessary for the very most talented person, and that's another intangible. How is that work going to play out? But she's certainly a singer I will be watching and wanting to hear more of.
F. Paul, you chose her as one of the next wave of opera singers. You know, what beside that voice, you know, led you to put her in the magazine as one of the faces of the future?
You want more?
Well, curiously, I mean, my own interface with her is I happened to be a judge in the Liederkranz competition, which was before the Met auditions. And I think there were five of us sitting at a table. And she walked in and said, my first selection is going to be Casta Diva. And I refer to that moment as a five-pencil drop, because all of us were poised to write something, and the pencils all dropped, and we just sat there and actually relaxed and listened. And part of what she has, in addition to the beautiful voice and the beautiful technique, is there is something about her I find incredibly centered. It's like I know that if she's flying my plane, it's not going to crash. I don't have to worry about whether or not she's going to be able to make it to the end of the phrase. I don't worry about whether or not she's going to have enough stamina to make it to the end of the evening. She has a sense of self, I guess, that is the best way of putting it, that reminds me of singers that I saw when I was first coming to the opera. I don't think she sounds like anybody else. She sounds like herself. But that self-knowledge and the confidence is something which is a big blessing for audiences.
So is that something so different than what we could have found from, you know, singers 10 years ago, if you would have done an article like this 10 years ago?
I think any talent like Angela Mead or the people here, or even the people 10 years ago, they're quite unique. And I don't know who we would have done if we'd done this 10 years ago.
I wrote one of these for you 10 years ago, but it was about singers coming out of Germany. But it was a similar
right,
thing,
exactly,
like who's
yeah.
the next
mm-hmm.
generation.
So, Anne, are there any singers in this Opera News article that you were kind of surprised, pleasantly or maybe otherwise, to see in the list?
Well, that's funny. There were a couple I didn't know, but most of them were names I recognized, and I think this is one of the results of having this sort of baseball-like farm team system of leading conservatories and apprentice programs that you start to get to know the next generation. A lot of effort has been put in America into finding ways to train the next generation and making opportunities for people after they leave conservatory, and that's a very good thing. But it also leads to, of course, you become partial a little bit. You start to root. You recognize these names. All of us who were there in 2007 at those Met auditions remember those singers, and so you're looking out for them, and the people who do the hiring are looking out for them. So there's an interesting, you know, it takes about 10 years to see who's really going to have the staying power and who sort of drops away after being the pets of who, and I'm not saying that it's not based on merit. I'm just saying that you become partial to your own a little bit.
We're talking about the future of opera. I'm Tom Heisengood. My guests are F. Paul Driscoll, editor-in-chief of Opera News. He's just published a cover story on the next wave of important opera movers and shakers. Also, countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo, one of those artists highlighted in the article, and Anne Majette, classical music critic of The Washington Post. I'd like to read you all a recent comment on a blog post from the OperaVore blog that is run by our good friends at WQXR. Someone commented, quote, "Lovers of classical music fail to realize the fact that many people dislike their music and come up with superficial reasons to explain it. The fact is, if there wasn't the over 60 crowd, audiences would not exist today. What will happen in 20 years is obvious." Anthony, does that remark make you nervous about your chosen profession?
It actually doesn't. Lots of opera singers spend time with other opera singers, and I have a very diverse group of friends, many of whom have never been to the opera. So I have the great pleasure of often singing opera for them or taking them to the opera for the first time. And that's very instructive to me, and it's important for me to read their reactions and to understand what they like and what they don't like. And almost unanimously, what happens is, and I feel like this is what I have started to try and create as an opera singer, there is a discrete instant. There is one moment, like when you break an orange peel and there's a spray of some, you know, fragrant zest that you can smell for a long time, but that is totally ephemeral. If you can have one instant like that, even if it's just for a second during an opera, where someone is really moved, where someone gets goosebumps, where someone connects to it, then you've got them, and then you're hooked. And I would say 80-90% of people who I bring to an opera or who hear opera for the first time have that instant. And I think that if we as an industry and as artists go around trying to make these instants and trying to not only make one, but trying to make every second that we're on stage like that, we might get lucky and have one or two of those a night, and therefore recruit an audience. So I don't totally agree with that. I think that people just aren't exposed to it, and when they do have some exposure and when they get over the fear of, will I understand what's going on? Will I understand the words? I always tell people, you know, as you will see the action play out on stage, if you take 2 minutes and read a synopsis, you won't have to look at one super title. Just watch it and take it in, and you don't need to get, you know, who's this person's aunt, and the important moments will be very clear. So I can't say that I agree with that comment.
Anne, what do you think about that comment? 20 years from now is obvious. There won't be anybody left to watch opera.
You know, there's been gloom and doom about the future of classical music for years. I think it would be foolish to deny that audiences are shrinking and the landscape is changing considerably. On the other hand, I don't think opera is going to die. I think there are a lot of people who are very invested in keeping it alive. We're going through a time of transition in a lot of areas, as Philip's piece points out, and some parts of opera may not continue to exist in the form we're used to, but I say it about newspapers, and particularly about music criticism in newspapers. People bemoan the dwindling of it, and I say a lot of it really hasn't been very good. And if it dwindles and we can replace it with a more vivid kind of writing about music, that's to the good. And I would say the same thing about opera. I think the best parts of it will prevail. and find ways to prevail because this art has endured for a long time and many of us care about it enough to keep it alive.
F. Paul?
15 or 20 years ago, no one would have ever thought you'd hear a Vivaldi aria on stage in a major opera house. And that's a composer who's being rediscovered, reinvented, listened to with 21st century ears. So I think that the way that opera would keep moving forward is to constantly reinvent itself. I think the other thing that we all have to look at is that the cultural base of opera was very much Western Europe. And certainly when the Met became the institution that it is now, in the beginning of the 20th century, there was an immigrant population in New York from Italy and from Germany that was supporting performances with Caruso or, you know, the early Puccini things. Right now, I think we have a big immigrant population in New York that's not connected to the art form at all. And I think America is different than it was 100 years ago. And I think in that sense, opera is different because it's reaching an audience which is not only getting older, but it's also getting broader.
You know, the era that we're living in, there's a generation of folks coming up that are used to kind of, you know, curating their own content, on demand, mobile, whatever, you know, and opera is something that you have to get up out of your, you know, seat and go to a house and sit down for 3 or 4 hours and listen.
I think it's even more basic than that. I think it's essential to remember that opera in the 19th century was a popular art form. Mm-hmm. It was like going to the movies. Mm-hmm. And opera no longer fits that slot in our society, but we do opera no favors when we try to make it all be high art and rip away those populist roots, because part of the fun of opera is that it is a little bit vulgar sometimes and kind of down and dirty and a little trashy in places, and then there are operas that are very high art. The really unfortunate thing about the idea of renewing opera into the 21st century is that most of the new operas that are written come from this very sort of high art place and don't lock into the popular culture as much in ways that I think would be healthier, that are just very much a part of this tradition. And it would behoove everybody to remember that. I mean, the comparison has been made between opera and sports, and it is, in a sense, it's a sports-loving crowd. You're there rooting. You're watching incredible athletic feats going on stage live in front of you. That's part of the appeal.
So how do we build audiences, I mean, future audiences for opera then?
If we had the answer to that, we'd all be off running opera companies.
Well, you guys are the experts. That's why I'm asking.
Well, I want to say a couple of things picking up on this. Is Anthony picking up on what Anne said? One is that as a performer, I have really tried to diversify my influences and my inspirations. So I had the opportunity to see Mick Jagger up really close and see what he was doing as a performer, or to see a cabaret performer like Justin Bond up close and see what they're doing. And to see the way they rally an audience and interact with an audience is really instructive, and I'm not sure that enough opera singers approach their sort of interaction with an audience in that way. And I think it's very possible to do that with opera. That's one thing. Another thing that I feel is important to remember is that opera is the original interdisciplinary art form. You know, in 1599, this group of Italian thinkers is sitting in Florence and saying, well, we've got this music thing and we've got this drama thing, and we should put them together and maybe add some dance and maybe add some fashion, you know, and add some art, you know, some scenery we can put up in the back. So it continues to be completely interdisciplinary, but now we have a lot more art forms, including namely technology. So I think as those art forms proliferate and become much more diverse, if opera continues to include them and becomes, you know, completely a cross-pollination of all these things, it can move forward with momentum and with speed. So I think that's important.
This is F. Paul. I think the other thing in terms of attracting new audiences, and this is my pet horse, I guess, in terms of new operas, all of them that I see tend to follow the same 19th century linear narrative, beginning, middle, end, act one, act two. And then you turn on television in a half an hour, you have something like Seinfeld, which zips back and forth in time, or CSI, where it's past or whatever. Nonlinear narrative is something that a really casual consumer of popular culture gets and understands. And I don't understand why opera can't take a little bit of that in.
I think that's a reason that Philip Glass's operas may prove to endure, at least the big ones, more than some of the more conventional, quote-unquote, operas that we're seeing now.
I think that's why Satyagraha, the production was marvelous, but certainly the Satyagraha at ENO and the Met, I think that, to me, on paper, that's something that's impossible to stage.
And I think that Jeremy Sams really achieved some of that nonlinear thought with The Enchanted Island, but also Handel was the king of that he's so internal and psychological. You know, there's a short burst of action, but then a character is sort of stuck in their memory or in their past or in their obsessions, and that's something we relate to, I think, in this very psychoanalyzed age of people.
Right, and the fact that they say the same thing more than once and then they decorate it the same way we would in a conversation if you have to restate something to make someone understand that much more.
I often think of an aria that's in da capo form, meaning there's an A, then a B, then an A, as, you know, you have a thought and then your mother calls, which is the B section. And you think, and then you go back to that original thought and you think, oh no, she's right.
I love that. That's a good way to get into new repertoire and new operas, and I'd like to quiz you guys about the state of new operas today. But first, let's hear a little bit of one. Silent Night by Kevin Putz. It's the Music Pulitzer winner from this year with the libretto by Mark Stephen Campbell, another one of the next wave opera people listed in the magazine.
Von Kronprinzen, keine neuen Waffen, keine neuen Männer, sondern Christbäume, zehn davon mit Lächerlich. Spring, jawohl, Herr Leutnant. Der Kronprinz wünscht Sie zu sehen. Sie sollen heute Abend auf seinem Fest singen.
Was? Wo?
Auf einem Schloss, etwa 30 Kilometer von hier, mit einer gewissen Anna Sörensen.
We're talking about the future of opera. I'm Tom Heisinger, and my guests are F. Paul Driscoll, editor-in-chief of Opera News. He's just published a cover story on the next wave of important opera movers and shakers. Also, countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo, one of those artists highlighted in the article, and Ann Majette, classical music critic of the Washington Post. Ann, are there enough good operas being written today?
Well, you need a lot of operas being written to have good ones be written, just like you need a lot of movies being made to have some good movies be made. I think that, as F. Paul was saying, we're stuck a little bit into this template of, okay, let's take a great book, let's take a great movie, let's put some pretty music on it, and let's make it into an opera. And I think also we're struggling with the fact that the opera audience is an audience that is almost by definition not musically avant-garde in its leanings. So the conventional subscriber audience that loves Bohème, loves Puccini, wants beautiful melodies and beautiful tunes, and trying to figure out how to create that has caused people to tie themselves in knots a little bit. I would love to see some more forward-looking work, and I think there are people trying to do it, but it's not always the opera houses that are the places to stage that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about some of the recent operas that are based on movies. You've got Silent Night, which we just heard, Dead Man Walking, The Fly, Il Postino, The Letter, and then those based on books, we've got Moby Dick, Heart of a Soldier, Little Women, Amelia. So, I mean, is there room for new stories and librettos?
Well, absolutely. And this is, of course, a very America-centric discussion, because if you go to
right.
Germany,
yeah.
you get a lot of nonlinear, weird, experimental stuff. I just wish opera houses were more open to it, particularly because I think regional opera houses are going through a bit of a cyclical thing where they've built up an audience, and that audience has actually gotten to know Rigoletto pretty darn well and maybe doesn't want to see it yet again. By developing a more knowledgeable audience, you've also developed an appetite for something new, and they're not quite sure what that new thing is.
Name me a couple of operas that have been written in the last 10 or 15 years that you think are dynamite and that, you know, that you just really like. Jump in, anybody.
We're all going after you. No, after you.
I did not see Unsuk Chin's Alice in Wonderland at Opera Theater of St. Louis, which was the American premiere, but I liked it very much in the production by Achim Fryer that I saw in video. I thought that was an interesting way of telling that particular story in 21st century terms. And I like the Scary in a Macbeth, which was another Occam Friar production that was done in New York about 8 years ago. I don't know how old the actual piece is.
You know, this doesn't quite fall within the 10 to 15 years, but Ligeti's Le Gros Macabre, which I had the great fortune to participate in with the New York Philharmonic, is a true masterwork, and I think it really embodies a lot of what we're talking about. Yeah. It embodies the ridiculous, the nonlinear, the very poignant, and the sort of choppy nature of what we see in film editing and TV shows today. In this particular scenario, the New York Philharmonic was very worried about not getting enough subscribers to buy tickets and selling enough tickets, and so they made YouTube videos, including Alan Gilbert, their music director, playing Guitar Hero with Death.
Right.
And we were completely sold out. Even the scalpers couldn't get tickets. And people were hysterical laughing. People were standing up in the middle of the show. I mean, it was a real rock concert atmosphere. And that came from Doug Fitch's direction. And it came from Ligeti's brilliant music. And, of course, the performers and the costumes and the whole synthesis, not to mention the orchestra. So,
but that's easy to sell out in New York, though.
It is easy to sell out in New York, and I think it is very esoteric, but I do think it has a certain appeal, you know, that there are operas that have either a rock show or a sort of independent film appeal that can be farmed out. And, you know, I think a lot of what Jake Heggie is writing really touches people in various communities in different ways.
In the last couple of years, the thing I've seen that I liked most was Moby Dick, and I hadn't been a big fan of Jake Heggie before, but it was of its kind. It was extremely well done, and that was partly because it was a great production and it was sort of well thought out and the artists are maturing together. But I would love to see more Grand Macabres going on.
Well, some of the best new operas, it seems to me, are being premiered at regional and smaller houses. I mean, you've got Silent Night from the Minnesota Opera. Before Night Falls came out of Fort Worth, run by General Director Darren K. Woods, who's also actually featured in the Opera News cover story.
I think it's true that interesting things are coming from smaller houses, but I think that there's a more intimate connection, perhaps, between the artistic staff of an opera house and patrons in a smaller city. And I think it also, there are some regional companies that have done some new things that have not been particularly successful. I think that those examples that you cite, I think, were quite interesting.
I was going to jump in and say, I think that also the thing about smaller spaces is that economic duress is forcing some companies to reinvent themselves or to think of new possibilities that are very productive. I mean, the Opera Company of Philadelphia, I don't think this is motivated by economic duress solely, but they have begun a chamber series in the spring, and they have allied themselves with the Gotham Chamber Opera. And I forget the third party in that triumvirate, but Nico Muhly's Dark Sisters is a premiere that grew out of that. They've been doing very adventurous stuff in the spring, and that was a company that used to be much more traditional.
So we've kind of come to the lightning round here, and as the end, I'd like you to imagine yourselves as the supreme overlords of the Ministry of Opera in America, and I'd like you to each name two relatively doable things that you would make happen right now to ensure the, you know, the success and vibrancy of opera.
Make it cheaper and make it shorter.
What do you mean by make it shorter? Actually writing shorter operas?
I think that's part of it, yes. I mean, I think that getting it more compressed, the newer operas especially, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of a short way to phrase it. I would love to see more emphasis put on the artistic side, purely in terms of the singing side. I think that singers are often thrown into opera without the kind of careful preparation they used to get and without a real understanding of what kind of voices would fit what kind of roles, and therefore you're more likely to get unexciting performances of repertory standards. And the way to find the crackle in opera that made us all fall in love with it is to put a little more care into the musical side, which is difficult to muster if you are operating under financial duress and a jet set age.
Mm-hmm. Anthony?
I'm going to talk about it from a performer's point of view.
Of course, of course.
I think that picking up on what Anne said, the focus for us singers on really direct and exciting communication is what will take opera forward, because that in my experience is what people respond to. And I think doing that in every possible context inside and outside the opera house is really important.
That's great. I'd like to thank my guest today, F. Paul Driscoll, editor-in-chief of Opera News. Thanks for being here, F. Paul.
Thank you.
And countertenor Anthony Roth Costanzo, many thanks for your time today.
Thanks so much.
And Anne Majette, classical music critic of the Washington Post. Always good to see you, Anne.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Heisinger, and we'll leave on a high note, I guess, of sorts. One of the other fresh-faced singers spotlighted in the Opera News article on the next wave of important opera singers, Alex Schrader and his Nine High Cs in Donizetti's A Mes Amis from The Daughter of the Regiment. Thanks for listening. This is NPR Music.
Me voici militaire.